A petu kele tan trokata kia hena a kewoas a ke na woo ki ek tatsa, un kasi la kantrenka. La krota wi choch an taku oi choch an yanka hechi. Le na heche un yechi la ashte na un yechi lo akram. Heche chonka hena a ke un ki troka ba hiagle ki han heche. Wi chon un chagwa mani ki, na wi chon un chagwa a uki le na hecha heche geluha. Trokata oyate piktacha, na tioshpa piktacha, eche trunkashila lena wash akeki, nie luhaki heun lena icheuni chiapi. Oyunka ioko ki heel heche, we chokuze eache. Asni pijashni heche, ikchewichasha oyate mitakue, koyag manik un hena wozani in ushinola pikte, na hena we chozani uchak uktonka heche, hena opkapie ha heche, wonia kilena luhaske. Na cha oegle kilena awai chai chilake. Heche tonka ohunkeshniki. Na wakhenja kilena heche trokata oyate pik tonka hel. Wo akhwala na wo lakhota. Na wo unspe ayan keki heche ikchewichasha. Kha wo unspe wa heche iotanla. Na iapi kile iotanla ktacha. Tunkashilo kantrenka lena wo ki. Ona ska shichu tkha wo unspe wa tokums ayan kanyukha heche. Tukte wa jicha yu ha trokata ilagi cha pik ta heche. Hena heche inusia laptacha.
Crazy Horse Singers, Juniors. can hear you. They can hear you. Na pewe chak upo church ashakim. Crazy Horse Juniors. Don't you just hate that when they fool you like that? Hail Traha, I used to fancy dance for 15 years before I started traditional dancing. Crazy Horse Juniors, they have a certain style to their songs. They look like they're almost gonna stop, but they keep on jamming. Oh, you traditional dancers, those of you that stop, now you guys know the style of the Crazy Horse Juniors.
That was Kelly Looking Horse at the Omaka Teka Wachipi from at the Oglala Nation from the year 2000, but it's still pretty beautiful, sacred music, dancing, words. And we started the Tashunka Witko Brigade with the prayer by Richard Broken Nose. And today we will do a domestic show, meaning within the borders of what is known and called the United States. This is indigenous land under siege. And we will dedicate the first half of the show to an effort to save the sacred Bear Butte, also known as Kresapa. And one of the people involved in that is Carter Camp, an old AIM warrior, and Wambli Watakpe, another old AIM warrior. Will interview him in a few minutes. But before that, I wanted to share with you the call that this group has put out to defend Bear Butte. This is a call to all Indian people. For two centuries, our people have struggled to preserve and defend our sacred mountain, Bear Butte. It seems like every year some Indian group or tribe is protesting or going to court or appealing to the governor to protect Bear Butte for some new destruction and desecration. Each year sees Indian people attempting to use every available avenue to prevent the further destruction of Bear Butte and its surrounding lands. Today, our sacred mountain is threatened as never before. Immense venues of drunken revelry are being carved into the land around her slopes, and the world's biggest biker rally will bring almost a million loud, polluting motorcycles and their thrill-seeking riders to the sacred mountain. They seem eager to dirty and disrespect our sacred lands in search of an escape from an empty American life. At first, they came into our sacred grounds as trappers, killing animals for their pelts. We fought them then and drove them away. Then more invaders were sent under Custer to dig for gold and take the land from our forefathers. Soon they were too many to resist, and the chiefs had to make treaties with them in order to protect the people's lives and our lands. Always they have been told the Black Hills are sacred and Bear Butte is sacred also, and it was included in the treaties as land that would belong to the people forever, never to be sold. Our ancestors clearly explained to the Americans that our sacred lands must remain within the care of the people, and the Americans agreed. Their Congress ratified it and their president signed it. It is only because the Americans have broken their own treaties with our nations that today we must continue the struggle of our forefathers. Recently, the announcement of a 600-acre biker bar campground and a giant man-made amphitheater and concert venue next to Bear Butte alarmed Indian tribes all across the Great Plains. Even more insulting was the promoter's plan to name it Sacred Ground and construct a giant statue of an Indian facing Bear Butte. Indian people began once more to rally to protect the mountain from this development. Several tribes passed resolutions, and once more groups and individual people began attending meetings and trying to persuade the county and state governments to prohibit this development. That part of the struggle goes on, and we are still attending meetings and filing our arguments against the development and against granting it a liquor license. We fully intend to continue to use these bureaucratic remedies in hope that we can establish some legal zoning and stop any development that way. At the same time, it has become more and more obvious that the immense amount of money Meade County and the state of South Dakota make off the Sturgis bike rally means that once again our pleas will fall on deaf ears. As we began exploring ways to stop the sacred ground's developer, we found out that he is far from alone in his intentions to develop biker bars and concert venues on grounds surrounding Bear Butte. We now know of at least a half a dozen major campgrounds and concert venues being planned and at least one under construction. These, in addition to some smaller ones already in existence that are getting ready to expand, and a giant one called Buffalo Chip that is approximately 4 miles away, mean that soon our sacred mountain will be surrounded by noise and drunken partying. Mega speaker systems, giant TV screens, fireworks, and 800,000 roaring motorcycles will drive animals, Indians, and spirits away from the mountain. They will destroy the land and dirty the water. Already her lake is drying and the water from her spring barely flows. We are traditional Indian people. When a crisis like this one threatens the people, we turn to our sacred ways to give us guidance. Since the announcement of the latest development, many prayers have been offered and many ceremonies done on behalf of our efforts to defend Bear Butte. Like so many of our ancestors, we ask that our words and actions be blessed before we decide how to go forward, and we pray that our decisions will be the right ones. As we continue in our efforts to defend Bear Butte, we intend to follow this way of doing things, so in the end we can do things in a good and respectful way. In past days, when matters of great importance were to be considered, a call went out to the people to gather together to make decisions that would affect all the people. Bear Butte, Nowawas, Mato Paha, our sacred mountain, is that important to the people, and the decisions made to defend her will affect all the people. A traditional call is now being sent out for all traditional societies to bring together their people at Bear Butte during the summer. We invite our own traditional chiefs, headsmen, and headswomen to come to lead and guide the people, and we will prepare a place for you. We invite our sacred men and women to come pray for our efforts and for us in a ceremonial way, and we will prepare a place for you. We invite our elders to come stand with us and bless us with your knowledge. We have a place for you in our circle. We ask all who sun dance and follow the sacred pipe to come lend your prayers and power to our struggle. We ask our youth, our future, to come stand beside us. We ask you to come early to lend your energy and strength to the sacred circle of your people. In the end, our call must be heard by all traditional Indian people. And we must gather together in unity, in prayer, and with determination to make this one grand effort to defend Bear Butte. Our gathering will be called the Great Intertribal Gathering of Nations, and it will be coordinated by the Intertribal Coalition to Defend Bear Butte. In early July, an encampment will be established at Bear Butte, and soon after, the sacred staff will be placed in its own teepee, and ceremonies will begin and will continue until the bike rally is ended. The date of the council meetings and other activities is yet to be decided, and all important decisions will be made as our circle grows and the time nears. Finally, we ask you to remember that ours is a society that values the drum, songs, and dance of our people. So bring your drums, we'll dance, and make our gathering a joyous Wachipi as we take care of serious business for our people. Owi Aku, a traditional group working on the Oglala Reservation at Pine Ridge, has been given the task of preparing the sacred staff and taking it to the tribes. Owi Aku means bring back the way in Lakota. And in this beginning, they will act as our contact point and fiscal agent for fundraising. A larger meeting of all concerned is planned for early spring. At that time, a more formal organization will be in existence. And this is an invitation to all traditional societies and indigenous people of this land under siege. The two contact people are Carter Camp. You can contact him at Carter Camp, CARTERCAMP at yahoo.com, or Deborah White Plume. She's the director of Owe Aku. And her phone number is 605-455-2155. Or Vic Camp, and his number is 605-455-1122. And you're listening to the Tashunka Witko Brigade on Free Radio Olympia. In a few minutes, we will have Carter Camp, who is one of the authors of that statement I just read, interviewed by Wambli Watakpe. You're listening to the Tashunka Witko Brigade, and we have Carter Camp on the phone, and Wambli Watakpe will introduce him and interview him.
Greetings and to your family and children and to the Ponca Nation. I think it's the last time we talked face-to-face was in Wounded Knee, is that correct?
Yeah, it's been a long time, man. I'm not sure exactly when the last time I seen you guys. I kind of keep track of you once in a while around the country, but haven't been up that way for a long time.
Before...
Are we recording now?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'd like to say hello to, of course, you and your family and all the brothers and sisters up there in the Northwest. You know, I haven't been up there in many years, but we're planning on making a trip up there. And I had planned to come to the Peltier Rally in Tacoma on February 3rd. And I guess we're still going to come up there. I was hoping that you'd still be in charge of the LPDC at that time. But even though you're not, I wanted to show the people around the country and in the Northwest that Leonard Peltier still has the support of the brothers and sisters that are here on the reservation and around the country. You know, that a lot of times the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the people that are against the American Indian movement and movement in general just try to say that Leonard Peltier don't have support of Indian country anymore. And, you know, no matter what happens within his committee or what happens around the politics of Leonard Peltier's incarceration, the people support him and his freedom. And I think people should really understand that we as Native people must continue to support his freedom, because, you know, he did something for all of us, and the stand that they took was for all of us and for people like you, us as a warrior, and me, and all the others that stood with Peltier. You know, it's just hard for us to go on with our lives knowing a brother's in prison, knowing sitting there. So we want to do what we can to encourage people to continue to support Leonard Peltier. But, you know, I'm an old activist, brother, so we got other things cooking, too, besides Leonard, you know. And I want to tell people about this very big gathering that we're going to have, and that's another principal reason I'm going to make that trip up to Washington State. On the way up there, I'm going to be visiting all the tribes around Idaho and Montana and Wyoming and telling them about the gathering that we're going to have at Bear Butte in order to protect the sacred mountain from the encroachments that's happening. A guy wants to build a gigantic bar there, 600 acres, drive-up biker bar and concert venue. And then the guy wanted to call it sacred ground, and it's right there at the bottom of Bear Butte, a place where over 30 tribes hold sacred. And they want to have the you know, all the Lynyrd Skynyrd concerts and Evel Knievel jumps and all these kind of things where our people have gone to fast for 10,000 years. And, you know, one of the reasons we're having this conference in August is because of the big bike rally they have in Sturgis. 800,000 bikers are expected to invade Indian country in August, and we think that we have a right to at least a 5-mile buffer zone around Bear Butte, and that they need to enforce a quiet zone so our people who are there praying and fasting won't be disturbed by this big biker rally. So we think it's going to turn into a really nationwide thing. I know this same bar owner wants to do it at Bear Butte, has other saloons called Broken Spoke Saloon. So we're organizing a nationwide boycott of that.
Do you know,
it's not just us and the Plains Indians that are having trouble with our sacred sites. you know, the Navajo and Hopi and the people down in the Southwest are trying to save their sacred mountain, sacred San Francisco Peaks. The Wasichu wants to put a ski lodge there and use recycled wastewater from their sewage to put on the Navajo Sacred Mountain. And, of course, the entire, well, you know, it's not just sacred to them. It's sacred to the Apaches and the Pueblos and the other Southwest Indians. And they're making an all-out effort to try to save the mountain from getting the wastewater poured all over it. And, you know, I mean, just the thought of that's really ugly, you know, that they would want to put wastewater on a sacred place. And then, of course, they want to pave an area around the medicine wheel there in Wyoming. And then up you guys' way, I know that I don't, you know, I'm not real knowledgeable about the sacred sites in Washington State and Oregon and that area, but I know that they have been under attack because I read about the inscriptions that were on part of the Columbia River Gorge and stuff that people are trying to protect, and then a place up in the place where the Nez Perce are from, they bulldozed some of their burial grounds and that sort of thing. So we're asking all the tribes who have sacred grounds, sacred lands that are threatened to come join with us, and we're going to start in about the middle of July and have a nationwide gathering and sacred site summit meeting at Bear Butte and Sturgis. And at the same time, we're going to ask all the medicine men, the sacred societies of our different tribes. I know that a lot of Cheyenne people are coming. That's their sacred mountain. Of course, Lakota Nation, it's a very important place to the Lakota Nation. That's where they gather to make their decisions for the entire tribe. Their chiefs gather and have their councils there in the fall. And, of course, our people fast there. So all in all, you know, we just think that it's time for us to stand again as a nation, stand together in unity, and just say that, you know, we're not gonna take this any longer. That every year we have done something. Every year we put bills in the legislature. We've gone to county commissioner meetings. We've told these white people till we're blue in the face that we don't want our mountain destroyed. But they don't have any ears, and so we have to gather there and force them and stop the desecration.
Is there could you talk about the some of the other activities, like the years mentioning about information camps and things like that, or other things that people can do to who to contact, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, I guess you know, the best thing is contact me. We're going to get up a website in this week, probably up by Friday or Saturday. It's going to be defendbearbutte.org. But, yeah, I think that mainly younger people than you and I, Russ, but my sons are included that in a movement for young people to start preparing themselves for the defense of the nation. And the Native Youth Movement and some of the young people from Canada have contacted some of the youth around here. And my sons are part of the leadership of the youth movement around here, and of course from Oklahoma and then other states as well. And they're planning on a get together where young men and women can come together in privacy and learn what they need to learn for self defense and for protection of themselves and their people, but also a chance to network with each other and other warriors and to decide how this next generation is going to protect the people and make sure that we survive for another 500 years. You know, when I was a young guy, you know, I was the age of my sons, we had the American Indian Movement. And in different places around the country, they had other organizations that were coming together and sharing information and deciding that they had to struggle to protect our people. Well, now it seems like those organizations, AIM and all the others, have died out. And there's really no organization for these young men and women that can come together on on a national basis and network with each other and tell each other, you know, what's happening, and then have phone numbers for each other so they can call each other in a crisis and come together. And so we think that needs to be reestablished. And I think the Native Youth Movement and here on Pine Ridge is a group called Owe Aku. Owe Aku means bring back the way. And they're going to have they have a website called bringbacktheway.com, I think. Either .org or .com. I can't get those states. But they're going to be having one of their first large national meetings in Oklahoma on May 17th, I believe it's the 17th. Anyway, it's a week-long meeting, and it's on the Ponca Nation, where I'm from. The Ponca Pazata, which is the Women's Scalp Dance Society, Victory Society, is hosting the Indigenous Environmental Network's National Convention there in May. So in conjunction with that, the youth of the United States, Indian youth, are going to be calling together a meeting in May in Oklahoma. And at that time, you know, they hope to formally get together with an organization and chapters and that. And then they will also be called on to provide security and that sort of thing for our gathering at Bear Butte in mid-July. So, you know, that's what's happening around here. You know, it'd be good if we could, when we come up there in May, that, you know, we could spread the word and get a group of young people might be interested in joining with the young people in Oklahoma and South Dakota and, you know, and just networking together so they can make the kind of organization that we had when we were younger.
Yeah, we've been passing the word. You're going to be here for the rally, for the Peltier rally on the 3rd?
Yeah.
Because we thought maybe we could have you speak at a school down here. It's a Native school on Frank's Landing. And then
I don't know very many people up there any longer. You know, I'm just an Okie, stay home most of the time, and so I haven't been up towards the Northwest, in 20 years. And sure, I'd like to see all the Native people, Native groups. To me, just coming up there for the rally is just a good way to get there, you know. Then we can go around and meet the people. So anything like that, we'll be glad to do. It's going to be me. It'll probably be like a van load of us, maybe a van and a car, myself and some of the young men and women.
Brings back memories, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, I want to turn all this stuff over to these young guys, but I got to get them kick-started first, I guess.
Yeah, your sons, I met them up in Bismarck. We took some kids from our school back there last year when they were working on that the opposition to the Lewis and Clark.
Yeah.
And maybe you can give some of the people some updates on how that turned out or how that's turning out.
Well, you know, the thing against Lewis and Clark, you know, as long as they were in South Dakota, we kept some pressure on them. But as they've moved up river, they've kind of moved out of our area. And, you know, the United States government put in millions of dollars to perpetuate a damn lie. You know, Lewis and Clark, we knew that they didn't come across this continent in any kind of way to make peace or to explore the land. That's all bullshit. They came across our land to survey our strength. They were like spies that come in to see how much wealth we had, how many soldiers we had, and how they could conquer us. And they were like the scouts for the conqueror. And they lied then when they come amongst our people. Now these fools coming on around in their silly costumes and coming upstream, they're perpetuating the same lie. They're saying that Lewis and Clark came for a totally different reason than what they came. They came to spread their conquest. Lewis and Clark knew everything that happened to the tribes of the East, how they had been murdered and genocide had taken place all the way east of the Missouri River. Then because of those of us west side didn't know that, they come with a lie. So they not only brought disease, they brought the conquest of our people. And I said, well, if you're going to sail up this river again a couple hundred years later, at least tell the truth. Tell them that they were agents that came amongst us bent on conquest. And they knew that they had bought, or they say they bought our land in the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, they bought it from the wrong people. They took it from us. So anyway, we wanted to expose that lie. And I think, you know, just at least giving the tribes an idea that there are some people along this river that won't take that kind of money, no matter, and perpetuate that lie. All up and down the river, all up and down the Lewis and Clark route, our people have taken money from the dogs. And they shouldn't have took that money. They should say, we don't want you to come amongst us unless you're prepared to tell the truth. You know, don't come back here with a lie 200 years later and say it's the truth again. You know, we didn't want to hear that. Unfortunately, you know, millions of dollars can overcome the voice of a few Indians. And they really put, you know, $100 million or so into this trail of Lewis and Clark. So the Indian voices, you know, they get drowned out, or they get some sellout to go dance around for them. And I don't know how it's going to be up there with you guys. I hope you guys confront them, too.
Well, we had, right before we went back there, we had at the school, the name of the school is Wahiloot, which is a warrior on the same level as Tishinko Witko and some of the brothers back in those tribes. And they had their, you know, the school, through the schools, that they perpetuate that colonial myth and the lie. We had a big confrontation within the school, and the end of that argument, we won the argument, and that's how we were able to take four young men and two of us chaperones, and we traveled back there 1,400 miles to Bismarck. We carried a staff from the Northwest, and we presented it to the people there at UTEC. And then we came back, and along the way we had stopped at different places, stopped in a couple of reservations to meet with people and to talk about Lewis and Clark. And then the party, or the Lewis and Clark expedition masquerade is going to culminate somewhere right south of Olympia in 2006, and so what we're trying to do now is just build up towards some kind of active opposition to it. Up here in the Northwest, as you know, the Battle of Seattle sort of set a really good example for resistance, and so there's a lot of those people still around, and there's a lot of empathy for the indigenous movement. So when you come up here, you'll be coming to an area that wants to hear about the indigenous struggle, because they're, on one level, they're tired of the old politics of organizing because they know it doesn't get you anywhere. And on the other hand, they don't exactly know how to confront the violence that's coming back at them to the state. So the only ones that can sort of talk about that with any degree of intelligence as Native people, since we faced it right from the very beginning.
That's right. Well, I saw that the old fort that Lewis and Clark built or something down there by the mouth of the river burned up, huh?
Yeah, the, I mean...
Oh, that's a goddamn shame. I saw that, and I said, well, maybe somebody heard us up that way too, so that's good. I mean, it's nothing to celebrate.
Down in Portland, we went down there for a Lawyers Guild meeting a couple months ago, and one of the schools down there that has a law school has a real active forum where they focus in on Native issues, including within the law and outside of it. And the name of the college is Lewis and Clark.
Yeah, right. I saw the one professor put some things on from Lewis and Clark College.
So it's kind of ironic that, you know, they did come out here on a recon mission, and they did, you know, the issue of Sacagawea always kind of has always been troubling. What is your take on that?
Well, you know, I used to live by Kennewick, Washington. And over there, we have, this was when I was a kid, they have Sacagawea Park. You know, and I guess that's some place where they might have came. It's on the Columbia, but But, you know, I think she was a slave. You know, I think she and the black guy that came with them. You know, when these reenactors come, they have some people like that. They hid the woman the place actually lives. She never come out and saw us, the real Indians. And then they had the black guy that was, you know, playing a slave. And he was half Sioux and half black. And we asked him, you know, what in the hell are you doing acting like this slave and stuff like that? And well, didn't they ever tell you that Lewis and Clark, you know, they never did free their slave. They had him, and he thought he was going to get free afterward, but they kept him a slave even when they went back. I don't even know who he belonged to. But it seemed funny now to see a black man reenacting that bullshit. And then the lady that was Sacagawea, you know, they tried to make her out nowadays as if, you know, she was a member of the, a valued member of that troop or whatever they were. But no, that... You know, that's bull. Indian men couldn't be equal to those, and women in those days were chattel. They had no rights at all. They were just property. And she was the property of some French fool, some trader and trapper, and he took her on that. And, of course, she was valuable to them. She could speak Indian language and knew sign language. And she was smarter than the rest of them. But that doesn't matter. She was a slave, and she was chattel, and she was used against her own people. So, you know, I feel sorry for her, and sorry for her life that she had to live.
Do you know what tribe she was?
Shoshone.
Shoshone.
That's what I was supposed to say. Shoshone. Well, I think that's what they brought in there to commemorate when they had the ceremony or something for her. I think they had Shoshones. She eventually made her way. I think she made her way back to her people.
Well, I know that a few years ago, that in the colonial capital in D.C., they made a statue of her, and they put it in what they call a Hall of Presidents or the Hall of some kind of hall that the colonial people honor their own people, and all of them are males, white males, and. They put up this statue in this hall, and it's I don't really know how to pronounce her name or what the right, you know, enunciation of the name, but it's either Sacagawea or Sacagawea, whatever. And so were you aware of that?
Well, yeah, I know they've tried to honor her. I'm not sure how different ways. I mean, they put her on a coin, different things like that. You know, they can try to cover up their genocide of our people in all kinds of ways. They made a museum in Washington, D.C. called the National Museum that is there specifically to hide the American genocide. And I felt real bad when all of our tribal leaders, our artists, tried to endorse that Museum of the American Indian, because that is their effort to hide their genocide of our people. You know, why don't they take all of the artifacts and all those things that they stole from us and give it back? And when everything they got up there that's Ponca, I'd like to take it home. Those artifacts mean something to us. They don't mean nothing to those white people. And if those white people want to know about Ponca Indians, they should come to our homeland. They could see how our people live, and they could learn about us. But there's no such thing as an Indian, and there should be no museum of American Indian. And, you know, it's just a constant effort to hide what the Americans are doing to our people. They did it for 500 years in America, and we took a pretty good beating. I mean, we're all colonized. But they're still doing the same thing to the Indians in Guatemala and South America all over. They're getting ready to probably assassinate every Indian leader that's coming to the fore down there. They're increasing the CIA budgets. They're hunting our people down in the jungle. You know, they haven't changed just because they lightened up on us. You know, they lightened up on us because they got us pretty well under control. But any time Indian people stand up and raise their voice in opposition to the Americans, you can believe that they're going to start killing a bunch of Indians, because this war ain't over. The war won't be over until they get every bit of our land. And it won't be over as long as there's a few of us left that will resist and stay on our land. So, you know, what they're doing with Sacagawea, with Lewis and Clark, with that museum, they're trying to cover up, and they're trying to hide what they've done to our people. But there's some of us that remember. You know, my grandparents were on the long walk of the Ponca. It hasn't been that long ago. I'm 64 years old, and my own grandma, my own grandpa, they were taken from our agency on the Niobrara River, South Dakota, and they were made to march by the cavalry down to Oklahoma. And one-third of my people died. And that was my grandparents. I don't know what other American have that experience for their own grandparents where the American Army marched them and a third of the people died, but it did to our people, so it hasn't been that long ago.
Yeah, I was following the hurricane in Katrina, after what I was seeing develop, I made a statement to some people about, well, that's nothing new. They have that history when they did all those long walks, when they made those people walk out of the inner city areas to wherever. And then in Fallujah in Iraq, they did the same thing when they leveled the city. They just told the people, leave or die. And then each tribe has their own similar death march to talk about. So I was trying to bring these comparisons to the forefront because I think the comparisons are the opening to discuss and to unite with other groups who are maybe not indigenous, but also to form solidarities, like you mentioned, the South American president and Bolivia, Evo Morales and Hugo Chavez and some of those brothers. I was wondering if you care to comment on some of the larger issues internationally.
Well, I think, you know, you and I probably have the same view on a lot of these things. And the war in Iraq that you mentioned, I have a nephew in Fallujah right now with the Marines. And I feel a little bad for him. I'm just praying that he comes home and safe. And I think he's supposed to rotate this month. I worry about Indian men and women that are there. You know, there's been some killed and there's been some shot and wounded. And some of them just traumatized by being there. And our people, you know, we've always fought their war for them. And I understand, you know, I'm a veteran. And you are, you know, so we know why young Indian men go into service. But, man, we got to educate our young people better, you know, that is not the only place to get a job. You know, they go in there to get work or get education or get off the reservation, and they end up, you know, having to fight a war against people who don't deserve to be fought. You know, the Iraqis were no threat to the Americans. You know, even with that long-standing disagreement between Christians, Muslims, and Jews that's been going on in the Middle East for all these centuries, you know, Indian people shouldn't take part in that. You know, this is an unjust war, and it's done just because the Bush administration, you know, decided that they should go in there. You know, a couple reasons. The principal one, they wanted to save that oil for the Western nations. And of course, the other one is because America is so tied up with Israel that they feel that protecting Israel is more important than a real good and true, fair American foreign policy. So instead of being fair-handed, even-handed with the countries of the Middle East, they always jump on Israel's side. And when Israel wanted to destroy Saddam Hussein, then it became a foregone conclusion that America was going to back them, and this is what happened. By the way, it's a war they can't win. I thought that maybe Vietnam would have taught the American people something, taught them that colonialism is dead. It can't happen any longer. No matter how rich a country is, Russia couldn't conquer Afghanistan, America couldn't conquer Vietnam, because colonialism is not possible any longer. But there's some diehard white people in the American government that don't believe that. They think that they can conquer and rule anybody. And all over the world, I mean, there's over 100 and 200 countries with American troops stationed in them. So it's the American American empire and whether they hide it from the American people or not, you know, eventually people get tired of being oppressed and they fight back. That's happening in South America, and it's going to happen more and more around the world as America has to oppress more and more people in order to keep their capitalist empire in shape. So there's going to be a lot of fighting. You know, usually they turn to killing Indians, you know, in South America. In Colombia, you know, they started killing the Indians there because American kids were snorting cocaine. You know, missing white kids in New York put cocaine up their nose. Well, then they rush down to Colombia and kill a bunch of Indians over it when they should be teaching their own people not to snort that cocaine. Don't use that sacred plant in that manner. But instead they think, well, we'll just wipe out the Indians, wipe out the coca production, we'll save our kids. But that's not the way it happens. You know, so they use various excuses for suppressing Indian people. It's just gone on too long. Gone on too long. Every place where there's an Indian majority, those Indian people are against that NAFTA, that CAFTA, and those things that ruin their economies. Because Indian people are smart enough to understand, you know, that money is not going to help people by free trade. It's going to some capitalist rulers, multinational corporations that are sucking the money out of the countries and leaving the indigenous people to live in poverty. So that's why the Zapatistas arose, you know, and that's why they're fighting CAFTA, NAFTA, tooth and nail all across South America. And that's why we should be doing something here in this country to support those South American Indian people who are trying to rise up. America has a bad habit of going down there and killing every Indian leader when he rises up. And if we could do something within this country to convince the CIA that the American people won't stand for any more assassinations of indigenous leadership, maybe we could save some lives of the indigenous leaders in South America, particularly Evo Morales. You know, he's in a precarious position. And I think we need to start a Save Evo movement or something before they're either going to go down and disrupt that country and make the people so poor and hungry that they'll throw him out, or else they'll just go down and outright kill people. So, well, I don't know how it's going to come out, but I'm very heartened to see the indigenous people of South America starting to come together and exercise their rights to political power and say that they're going to put a new kind of country together and it's going to be a better country. You know, I wish them luck. I hope I can help them in some way.
Yeah, I'm with you, and my heart goes out and to the people of Bolivia for doing something, making a referendum stand that has historical magnitude and impacts. So you're going to be coming out this way and speaking. And how long are you going to stay? And then what can?
Planned on anything outside of just that rally, you know, because our plans have just been such that I couldn't say, well, I can be here on a certain date. But if we think of the rally as like the first day that we'll be there, you know, then we could probably stay another 7 days or something like that, 6 or 7 days before we start back, come back this way. So many people and stuff as we could visit between the 3rd and 10th, I guess, some just approximately, that's what we'd like to do.
Well, we can have, like I said before, we were working on some speaking gigs at the schools, but one of the schools is Evergreen State College, and we have one of the organizers and DJs of Furl Radio is trying to organize out at Evergreen, so we could also include Evergreen. Do you have any... what's happening on the res?
Well, nothing. Nothing changes on these reservations, man. I'm staying here in Manistee. You know, I'm from Oklahoma, of course, but I got sons here on Pine Ridge that are Lakota Oglalas. And, you know, so I get up here every once in a while, but really not a whole lot changes. You know, the IRA system of government doesn't work. And it doesn't matter if you're in Oklahoma where my tribe is falling apart, or if you're here in Oglala where these guys are having such a hard time with the government. wherever there's an IRA government, it doesn't work for our people. So I think here on the Pine Ridge Reservation, the traditional chiefs and headmen are once again getting tired of this government, and I believe that they're going to make a change. That's just my prediction. You know, I don't have any concrete information, but I just hear so many traditional people saying, well, over 50, 70 years they've had this IRA system, and not one time has it done anything good for the people. And it's getting worse and worse. And, you know, when we were here in 1973 at Wounded Knee, there was 12,000 Lakota on this reservation. Right now there's over 40,000, like 43,000 people on this reservation, and nothing has gotten better for them economically. You know, our spiritual ways have come back, our language is coming back, and our sun dances are strong. But economically, the government, the federal government, the American government, continues to bleed the resources out of Indian country. Our resources don't go to the people, it goes to Washington or to big companies that come in here and utilize our resources. You know, so I believe, and I support any of these tribes that want to change the IRA system of government and take back, you know, their government just like they're doing their land. You know, and I see that happening here. I see the treaty councils getting real strong. Their voices are being heard, and the people are starting to, you know, to hear them and listen more to them than they do with the IRA chiefs. So you know, there's always that hope, you know, that we're going to combat the colonization that is taking place, and that we're going to place a government here that's going to be of the people, real of the people. Also, you know, I got my son's uncle here is Alex Whiteplume. He's the vice chairman here, but also their Teospaya has been carrying on a struggle over growing hemp here.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, the Ogallalas, they passed their law differentiating between hemp and marijuana and requiring anybody who wants to grow hemp on this reservation to carry a program of testing and to test the plants to make sure that they have no THC in them. Well, the Teospaya did that, and they planted 3 acres, I think, of hemp, and for 3 years in a row, the DEA has come in here and tore down their crop and prevented them from selling it. And then, the DEA didn't come do that when it was little. They waited till they'd spent the whole season growing it, and it was big. They had tested and turned over their independent lab testing. It had no THC in it, and they had sold their crop for a few thousand dollars, enough to get them through the winter. But when the DEA came in and stole all their mature crop, you know, it really hurt them economically. They had to sell half of their herd of horses just to be able to stand, you know, keep from going bankrupt. But just 2 weeks ago, it was the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis heard their appeal, and for the first time, the Whiteplume family got to go in and have an oral argument. See, they had just had a non-trial findings here, so on the appeal, this was the first time they were able to argue orally, and they were able to put in the fact that that the treaties guaranteed them the ability to utilize their own land, and that there was never a provision for the government to rule what they grew and what they ate and how they, you know, they took care of their own land. So the judges really seemed to listen to it. Some of them said the American law and policies were asinine. That was an appeals court judge said that. So it gave the people here a little bit of hope that these judges might say, well, there is a difference between hemp and marijuana, and that the Oglalas, in their laws and in their jurisprudence, they took care of that, you know, and that they should be able to farm that hemp. But, you know, if you depend too much on these appeals judges, you get disappointed, because they could certainly rule against them. But we're keeping our fingers crossed, and we think that the ruling should come in probably in April.
That's good news, because I met when I was in San Francisco, Deb and Alex came out there for the Bioneers, and they really had a lot of support out here, and especially in the Bay Area, because they had issues in the medicinal marijuana.
The government's running over all that too, you know, the federal government, because they got a right-wing court. On the whole issue, I don't understand it, you know, that they wouldn't allow sick people to take it as medicine, or they wouldn't allow farmers to grow hemp when it don't have any properties that would make anybody high or be able to smoke it. I mean, all these things are just, to me, are just the way that these police forces are able to pad their budget. You know, the people who are taking medical marijuana, or the people that are growing hemp, have nothing to do with drugs. But by, you know, harassing them, then the law enforcement can get a FBI and DEA can increase their budget, you know.
Speaking about hemp, maybe you could talk a little bit about all the many ways that can be used, because you're right, the right-wing media propaganda machine has only painted one narrow picture of hemp, and it has to do with the getting high part. But could you talk about some of the other uses of hemp?
Well, you know, since I've been here amongst the hemp growers, you know, it's not my area of expertise, but they've kind of educated me on it. You know, like there's some books here, and they got a lot of supplies here. They just built a little community building here, and they insulated it with hemp insulation. And if you've ever seen all that that glass kind of, spun glass kind of insulation, you know how sticky that is and hard to use. But the hemp fibers are just soft, and you can put it on your walls without, you know, wearing gloves and breathing that fibers and that sort of thing. It's just, you know, that's just one of the things. I mean, they have so many different kinds. You can make anything, I guess. You know, you can make plastic out of it. And you can make clothes out of it. The oldest pair of moccasins they've ever found on the Great Plains here was sewn with hemp fiber. And so our people have always used hemp as a good, strong fiber. But nowadays, you know, just science has made it into everything. And the odd part of it is that they allow over 200 and some tons to be imported from Canada, and they won't let the farmers here grow it. I mean, that's one of the things that Judge said was asinine. Why would they allow Canada or Mexico to grow hemp and ship it all in here, but they won't allow the American farmers to do it? By the way, it's not just an Indian thing either. Farmers all over the country, in the Midwest here in particular, are trying to get the government to allow them to grow hemp, because it's a product that could be revolutionize things in the United States. Like we use so much lumber, and a lot of us, you know, say, well, we're clear-cutting the forest, we've got to stop that. Well, most of the small lumber is going to pulp for paper and other things. Well, hemp as a renewable crop and a fast-growing crop could just supplant all the paper. I mean, the hemp paper is better anyway. But it can replace all the paper and save all those forests. You know, and it'll grow. It's the kind of plant that will grow in land that's not real, real rich. And, you know, on the reservations, of course, they moved us to reservations that didn't have a real good land. So it could be a savior for our farmers here. And, you know, like I said, it's just, there's a total difference. Anybody who knows the difference knows that if the DEA says that, well, it could be mistaken for marijuana or be used to cover for marijuana. No, they're totally different. Marijuana is a real bushy plant that's real big and looks like a tree. These hemp plants are just straight, little bitty straight stalks. They stick up about 7 feet, and they're just straight as an arrow, and they grow real close together. And so, you know, if there was a marijuana plant stuck amongst those hemp plants, then it'd look all out of place. So it's not like a camouflage for a marijuana farm or nothing like that. It's a crop like any other crop that's useful to the people. And, you know, trying to talk sense to the DEA is, you know, they don't understand those kind of distinctions, no matter how often you tell them.
Yeah, the DEA has made a living out of the so-called war on drugs. I mean, how many DEA agents have we heard about just randomly involved in big trafficking operations down in the Columbia and so on.
Of course, you know, it's the laws that's creating that high dollar amounts that's corrupting the DEA and other government officials all in every country. If they didn't have those draconian laws, you know, it wouldn't be that way. So they're bringing a lot of this stuff, you know, upon themselves, and, you know, in my estimation. Here on this reservation and reservations around the country, drugs are bad. And we are really against drugs. You know, some of the grassroots people on the reservation here and other reservations are getting so tired of the police not being able to stop these meth dealers and crack dealers that we're going to start doing it ourselves if we have to burn them out. I mean, we're against drugs, and I don't like drugs, and none of the people here do. But it's a whole different thing when you talk about planting a hemp or planting a medical marijuana. That is not like the meth that's destroying our children, the alcohol that's destroying our people. Those are the bad drugs that we got to struggle against, and we got to stop if our people are going to survive. And at the same time, we got to tell the government to get real and quit playing around with medical marijuana and hemp and get after these damn drug dealers that are hurting our people.
Yeah, the whole issue of gangs, how the police had first started off with this repression and suppression, has turned into where they're using, like when we were in San Francisco, we saw the police actively working with the gangs out in the Mission District, and they used them as some kind of, you know, cadet program to maintain control within the community. And so associated with that, of course, was the drugs. And we watched it right there on Cap Street and 24th, which is right in the heart of the Mission District, where it's mainly brown people.
Yeah. Well, it's been a long time since I've been out on the West Coast. I had to go out there and visit the tribes out there. I know that their sacred sites are being endangered, too. So we would really like to make this gathering here in midsummer a real national gathering so we can all come together. All tribes have these things. And we got to solve this, you know. We got to tell, you know, in their treaties they made with us, we reserved places like Bear Butte, and we told them that we have to take care of those places, you know, that they're an integral part of our nations, and for us to survive into the future, they have to be a part of us, and we'll take care of them. Well, you know, they broke their treaties, and they don't seem to be able to understand when we clearly tell them that those places are vital to our people. So, you know, we're going to have to take that step, and we're going to have to start protecting those places no matter what they say. So I hope we can spread the word and ask the people up there where you're at in Washington, Oregon, and Canada support us. I know some of the Blackfoot people in the mid part of Canada offered their support. And, you know, we're going to be getting around and telling people that, you know, since the white man hasn't declared the Indian wars over, I don't think that Indian people can stop resisting. We got to continue to in our resistance, and if we don't, we're going to disappear.
And with that, I think we'll conclude. You have any last closing wisdoms that you want to?
Well, brother, I think that was it.
Okay.
That was my closing wisdom right there. But I really am glad to talk to you, Paula. You know, I got a lot of things to talk to you about in person when I get up there and see some old friends. You know, I haven't seen the people in the Northwest that came to Wounded Knee, you know, since Wounded Knee, so. You know, I don't know how many of them are still kicking or stuff, but I know we're all getting kind of up there in age. So it'll be nice to get up there and visit with all you. And I want to say hello to all the different tribes. You know, I read about the Makah whaling, and Makah means medicine in Ponca. And then I see all the tribes coming in with the great whaling ships and doing all those gatherings. And I've always wanted to get back up to Washington, so I'm going to have that opportunity in February, and I look forward to seeing everyone.
Well, we'll be up here, and we'll touch base with you then. And of course, you're always welcome to come down to my teepee and grab a piece of the floor or whatever, you know.
You got it.
Okay.
All right, brother. Take care, man.
Oh. Bye.